Welcome to the special episode of Hanover Happenings. In it, we host Vermont Secretary of State Sarah Copeland Hanzis and New Hampshire Secretary of State Dave Scanlon here in Hanover to talk about civic participation, elections, and trust in government. It's a really interesting conversation, and we cover a wide range of ground. This is in part a follow-up to a conversation that we had on Hanover Happenings a couple months ago with supervisors of the checklist, volunteer ballot clerks, our town clerk and our town moderator, all of our local elected election officials talking about how local elections are actually put together and all the work that goes on behind the scenes. So you can check that out too if you're interested in learning more. You can find all of the episodes of Hanover Happenings wherever you listen to podcasts or at hanoverhappenings.com. Enjoy. All right, so welcome everybody to another Hanover Happenings podcast. This is a super special one. We've got two really interesting guests here today. Privileged to have our New Hampshire Secretary of State and Vermont Secretary of State here with us to talk a little bit about civics and trust and everything related to that. So thank you both so much for being here.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks, Alex.
Yeah. So now, as I've been coming up to New Hampshire and have a little bit of a foot in the New Hampshire world, a little bit in the Vermont world, I'm learning all of these kind of similarities and differences between the states that I didn't know about previously. But maybe we can start with, just for folks that are tuning in, may not be super familiar with Secretary of State and responsibilities, love to hear a little bit about each of your backgrounds. I know both of you have spent time in the legislature before being in this elected statewide executive position. So I'd love to hear a little bit about background, and then a little bit about maybe the sort of scope of the Secretary of State in your state.
Excellent. You get to pick who goes first. You're the host.
I think, yeah, that's true. Well, why don't we give to our guest, so Sarah Copeland Hanzis.
That's great.
Yeah, thank you for coming out from Vermont, making the trip across the river.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about your background and what's happening in the Secretary of State's office in Vermont.
So, quick background. I was born in Illinois, but my parents moved to Vermont when I was a year old, and I have spent most of my life living in the Bradford area. So I'm actually just up the road. Come through Hanover all the time, for goods and services. I was a middle school science teacher before I was able to stay home with my kids for 8 years. Mm-hmm. And when my kids were 8, 6, and 4, I ran for the Vermont House and spent 18 years in the legislature, 2 years as majority leader, and then for the final 4 years, I was chair of the Government Operations Committee. The Government Operations Committee oversees most of the activities of the Secretary of State's office, and so I became really familiar with the policies that the Secretary of State was working on. And when Jim Condos announced that he was planning to retire, I started thinking, wow, having a year-round job would be really fun because right. A citizen legislature is
that's tough, right?
It's tough. Yeah. It's tough to patch it together. Mm-hmm. While I was in the legislature, after my kids were a bit older, I started a business. So I had a little cafe on Main Street in Bradford, which is the perfect place for a citizen legislator to get to know their neighbors and to be always available and accessible. People would see my car parked outside and they would come in and tell me what, what they needed or ask a question or ask for my help with something. So
it's a local district office.
Very, very right. Local district office and, would you like a cup of coffee with that?
Right.
Full service. So the Secretary of State's office in Vermont has four main divisions. We do elections. We do corporate registrations. We are in charge of the state archives and state records, and we are in charge of the Office of Professional Regulation, which licenses or registers most professions. There are a few exceptions out there that are licensed elsewhere.
Great. I'll appreciate that background.
Yeah. Interesting. I grew up in New Jersey. I went to college and got a forestry degree, and right out of college moved to New Hampshire with a job practicing forestry. I lived in Canaan for probably 25 years, so I'm really familiar with the Upper Valley and how interconnected the community is, not only with the Vermont, with the New Hampshire towns, but also the towns across the river. while I was working as a forester, I got involved in politics and also ran for the legislature, served 8 terms, 16 years in that role. For my last term, I was the majority leader of the New Hampshire House. And then Bill Gardner, the longtime secretary from New Hampshire, who served for 45 years, needed a new deputy at the time. His former one retired and asked if I would join in and become a part of the Department of State in New Hampshire. So I served in that role for 20 years until he decided to retire. When he did, I moved up to the role of Secretary of State and then stood for election by the members of the legislature this last past December, got elected, and so that's my new role, my new responsibility. Mm-hmm. The Secretary of State's office in New Hampshire is responsible for elections, registrations of corporations, and any business entity that operates in the state of New Hampshire. We also have the Division of Archives and Records Management. We manage probably millions of state agency documents for the agencies. We have a Division of Vital Records, which I think is unique among all the 50 states, where we keep track of all the births, deaths, divorces, marriages, and important vital statistics like that. And then there's a lot of ancillary duties that we do. We process commissions for notaries public and justices of the peace. We issue hawker and peddler's licenses. There are many filings, a lot of them legislative filings that have to be made with the Secretary of State. You know, we keep track of all the campaign finance records and things like that. So we have significant ministerial duties, but we're also engaged in the political scene and the process of conducting elections.
Hmm. So it's interesting because both of you had a long history in government, but both of you recently ran for election for the position that you're in. And I don't know, 30 or 35 states where it's elected and the rest that are appointed. Is there any, you know, does the election change the dynamics of the office at all? And how's it like having just run? I know you just got sworn in very recently. So what's that kind of been like post-election so far?
So, there's a lot to cover there. So I think that sitting in an elected office as Secretary of State means that we are accountable to the people who elected us, right? You know, and every other year I will go out and you know, talk about what I've accomplished and ask for the voters' trust again. And I think that model works really well in our small state where it is possible for me to be present in every community over the course of the election. When I was elected and before I was sworn in, my husband and I decided that we're going to join the 251 Club, which is you visit every 251 towns or cities in Vermont. And so we visited the 3 towns that I have represented in the legislature on December 31st to take a picture in front of each of the town offices. And then over the course of the coming year, or probably two, it may take 2 years, we'll visit every other community in Vermont. And, you know, my goal is to take a picture in front of the town offices as we just, you know, that's my promise that I visited your community. You know, you can pick whatever spot in each 251 town you want to go to. But I figured since I'm the Secretary of State, I should visit the municipal offices.
That's great. We were just talking about that before, too, is the Secretary of State kind of getting out, especially with the local election officials and engaging there.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a really neat idea, going around, you know, visiting and getting a picture in front of each town hall. I'm pretty sure I've visited every community in New Hampshire over the many years that I've lived there, but that takes it to a new level.
You've got to have photographic proof.
You need
of
proof,
everything.
Right. Yeah.
There will be a picture book at some point, I'm sure.
Right. Yeah, that would be a good collage. Yeah.
I'm going to do it all in my electric vehicle as well. Right. So
So you're right that, you know, there's quite a few states that elect their Secretary of State at large, and Vermont is one of those. There are only three states where the legislature elects the Secretary of State, Maine, New Hampshire, and Tennessee. And so I think that the relationship between the constituencies that elect the Secretary a little bit different. In some states, because the Secretary is elected on a partisan ballot, on the November ballot, there is some, you have to campaign among the members of that party to be the nominee and then get elected. Whereas the secretary that is elected by the state legislature has to do that to a degree. But there is more, from my perspective, the secretary needs to be more concerned about being balanced and objective and nonpartisan. I think most secretaries that I've gotten to know over the years do a really good job separating the political component of their election from the administration of the office, and I think that's really, really important. And then, of course, each state is, you know, the demographic makeup is unique from state to state. You know, their political viewpoints can differ widely, and, you know, I think New Hampshire and Vermont is probably a pretty good example of that. There's certain political contrast between the two states, and that's reflected in the election laws, for example, that they're passed by the legislature and enacted in each state. I think Vermont is probably a lot more progressive in the way elections are conducted than in New Hampshire, but I think both systems work really well. And the important thing is that the results that are reported on the night of the election are accurate, and that the voters in the state have faith and trust in the results.
Yeah, and that's something that is a great segue to the next question that I'll throw out, which is just what is trust? I mean, trust has become such a big discussion topic, especially from an election standpoint, but in so many other areas of government and beyond that now, you trust what you read online, or are you trusting other people that you're getting information from or sharing information with? So what does trust mean to each of you generally, and how does that sort of interact with the Secretary of State position?
Well, I really feel like trust is so foundational to the work that I need to do as Secretary of State, and you know, I think it's going to be very important to always be mindful of pushing information out and be, you know, practicing radical transparency, as they say, because there are so many places where you can see misinformation creeping in, or people conflating a story maybe they heard from a different state that has different election laws and assuming that that's happening in Vermont. And, you know, so I think it's a constant, it's going to be a constant process of sharing information about how we know our elections are secure, how we, you know, how do local election officials conduct elections, what are the checks and balances in place so that they are sure that the people who are voting are the residents of that community. There are a tremendous amount of, rules and procedures in how we conduct elections that I would imagine, you know, 99% of folks in Vermont don't really know about.
Right.
And so I think it's always important to share that information to make sure that people have access to that information. And at the end of the day, in Vermont, as in New Hampshire, in each community, you probably know who your local election official is. In fact, you probably elected him or her. As in Vermont, most of our town clerks are elected, and so that should give people a lot of faith that that this is a known person who raised their right hand and swore to uphold our election laws and conduct free and fair elections.
Hmm. Yeah, and I agree with that 100%. Trust is something that has to be earned, and earning that trust is ongoing. It never ends. And the important ways to do that is to make sure that the process of elections, conducting elections, is as transparent as it can possibly be. The only thing that should be secret about elections is how each voter, each individual voter, marked their ballot.
Exactly.
And then the other component is a constant effort to educate the voting public about all the processes that are taking place, especially on the day of the election, helping them know and understand that there are many checks and balances at play, actually in the polling place, that are not visible, but they are there. And probably one of the most important ones is the fact that, at least in New Hampshire, I think it's true in Vermont, but the local election officials are elected locally. They're your neighbors, and you elect them because you trust them and you have faith in their ability to do the job. They all take the oath of office, and you know, for something to be done to intentionally change the outcome of an election in a malicious way would take a huge conspiracy because of that, that characteristic of our elections. That there's in New Hampshire, there are thousands of local election officials that are running our elections for the state, and they're all dedicated. They're human, so there are human mistakes that occur in every election, but that's part of the process, and it's part of the reason why we can trust the results.
And I would imagine in New Hampshire, it's the same as in Vermont. At the local level, the local elections administration is being overseen by people who hail from both parties or might be independents. And so, you know, you alluded to it being pretty impossible to imagine some sort of broad conspiracy. Well, we have built-in checks and balances, you know, one person looking over another person's shoulder to say, yes, I agree, that's a number 12, and we're going to put in 12 votes in that spot. So there really are a lot of good systems put in place to make sure that we can all, get up the next morning and say, yep, we agree that, you know, this was the way the election came out.
And our elections are designed so that if people want to participate and help out and be a physical presence themselves in the polling place, they can volunteer to do that. They can either run for the election official positions at the local level, or they can go to the town clerk or the moderator and say, you know, I'd really like to help out on election day. What can I do? And I'm sure that most election officials would welcome that, that help.
Yeah, I think that is quite the case in Vermont. There's always need for more folks to help. I mean, our clerks tell me that election day is a 16-hour day. And so, you know, the more hands, the lighter the work.
Well, there's two interesting things on that last piece. I think we've kind of talked about that a little bit in Hanover, too. We were chatting about elections a couple months ago with some of our local officials and, you know, touching on some of these topics a little bit. And it was either a clerk or moderator who said, you know, if you have a concern about the Hanover election, become a ballot clerk. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a couple hours of a lift, but the bar is low in the sense that it's accessible to people, and the power differentials between who runs the elections and who votes in the elections is very close. And in both of New Hampshire and Vermont, you know, it's not like it's you have to be in for 10 years and have degrees and know the right. If you want to see the process from the inside, you can, and that seems like a big benefit as far as. Even if not everybody does that, which most people, of course, don't, but knowing that that's available, I think makes a big difference in the general narrative. Mm-hmm. And I know you've talked about, Dave, on the New Hampshire side, there was a state bipartisan committee or commission that was looking at election credibility and that, folks from all perspectives are sort of brought into the process. And, you know, that's something that I have, as a manager on the local government side, if we're designing committees that are meant to look at housing issues or redevelopment issues or budget issues, you know, don't take the critics and keep them out. Bring them in. Say, if there's an issue that you have with the process, come on the committee and help us do it better, but buy the person into the process.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to speak to a dynamic that seems like it's changing, and I wonder if either of you have noticed this or have any reflections on how much or little people are likely, are people buying into institutions as much as they were 10, 20, 30 years ago? Is that a, if that's changing, is that sort of good or bad? And I don't know, is that a dynamic that you're sort of tracking in the work that you do? People's willingness to participate in wanting to change something by being involved in the institution versus sort of throwing stones from the outside.
Yeah, well, that comes right to the heart of the issue of why I'm focusing on education and civic engagement. Because I think that in order for people to feel inspired or empowered to participate, either at the municipal level or to lobby their legislature or to contact their governor for something that they feel they need to understand how those systems work and where are the levers of power. You know, what is a state issue versus a local issue versus a federal issue? And what flexibility or influence can any one individual have within that system? And I just think there are so many folks in my state who either never had civics education, so they don't understand the vertical tiers, levels of government, nor do they understand the three branches and the checks and balances inherent in our systems. And so it's really hard for them to figure out how to get in and make a change, even when they see one. And people get frustrated by their lack of understanding. And I think that frustration sometimes leads people to say, well, I'm just not going to bother voting.
Right, forget it. Right.
You know, nothing's going to change anyway. But the fact of the matter is, you know, that person may care very much about the availability of affordable housing. I might care very much about that. Every person in this room might care very much about that very same issue. But if we don't ever talk to each other about it, and if none of us knows how to influence the people who are in power and have the ability to make changes, then we can't fix that. So let's see if we can empower people to really take a hold of their democracy and make it work for them.
And you've got some plans to expand civic education in Vermont. I know it sounds like there was a pretty interactive curriculum that was being developed, a position that was being considered. Could you share a little bit about what you're thinking and what your plans are there?
Yes. So we're in the hiring process right now. The position is called Education and Civic Engagement.
Where can people find information about that if they're curious?
So the posting just closed on the state website, so you can't find the job listing anymore, unfortunately. We are starting interviews this week, and I'm hoping by the time we get back from our national conference that I will have some finalists to interview. Phase one of that person's job duties is going to be to assemble a group of teachers to ask for feedback and advice on, you know, what types of civics lessons work at the various grade levels and how can we create something that is just easy plug and play that that any teacher can say, great, I need to teach to this standard, and so here's this unit and this lesson that I can do. And here's the materials, you know, available online and easy to access. Phase two of that person's role, though, will be to get out into the communities with me, because we have to recognize that there's a whole lot of adults, probably in New Hampshire as there are in Vermont, who either forgot what they learned about how government works or they never had a class to begin with. And so I can imagine, you know, going to county fairs and tabling at farmers markets and having, you know, open public forums to help people understand how do you activate your government for you? How do you band together with other people who have the same concerns or the same idea that you have and help make that a reality? And then phase three is going to be to create a voter guide, because over the years, and you've probably experienced this as well when you were running for your House seats, Dave, is that you talk to people about the upcoming election, and at the end of that conversation, your job as a candidate is to say, can I count on your vote? And so many times over the years, I would say that to somebody, and they would say, "Ugh, I don't vote. I don't know any of the people on the ballot." And I'm like, "Well, you just met me. Come on.
You know one. Right.
Look for my name." But, you know, but there is a bigger problem there. And the bigger problem is that, you know, people don't necessarily have time, or the local newspapers don't have the ability to cover in depth the different people who are running for different offices, or even what the different offices do. And so our voter guide in 2024, I'm hoping to get that out for the general election, will have, you know, all of the offices, all of the candidates, and will require candidates to give us their website, their social media handle, their contact information, so that voters can reach out and contact them. But also, I'm going to ask folks to, you know, just give us a 100-word explanation. What are you going to do if you're elected to this office? You know, why are you running for this office? And I'm hoping that that will be really helpful for people to be able to discern who they want to vote for.
Interesting. Now, my sense is that in the past, there were organizations that we've seen a decline in membership and activity of that provided some of those sort of civic adjacent functions. Mm-hmm. Have you been seeing that? Like, it seems like there's basically more and more that government is required to do that outside entities may have done in the past. Basically, who's taking responsibility for these things? And you mentioned local media. I mean, there are a lot of communities. I know this was the case in New Jersey too, but I've seen it here as well, where there really is no local media. You know, yes. You might get an article a month or two on a big issue, mm-hmm. but the day-to-day stuff that's really important, there's nobody reporting on.
Right.
And I wonder if that's come across, you know. Yeah.
Well, I don't know if this is the case in New Hampshire with your small news outlets, but over the years, what I noticed during my time in the legislature is that, you know, it used to be that you would be called and be interviewed by somebody about the upcoming election, and then they would write an article about the candidates who are vying for that particular office. And over the years, more and more, different news outlets just email you and say, you know, we'd like you to answer these 5 questions, and you have to do it in 200 words or less, you know, and then they just, you know, they print that, which is great. But the problem is, you know, if you're a candidate and you get asked to do that on, you know, from a dozen different media outlets covering 100 different topics, many candidates just say, "Oh, I don't, you know, I'm not even going to bother to do that." So I figure if we can do that in a central way from the Secretary of State's office, people know at least there is one voter guide that everybody's going to get, and that's the one you should make sure you take a few minutes. And, you know, I'm not going to ask issue questions. I'm just going to say, give me 100 words. Why are you running for this office? That's really all the voters need as a starting point, and then, you know, people can do their campaigning from there.
It's a tough climate today for voters to really understand what the issues are accurately. You know, we see nationally the politics between the two major political parties is just completely polarized, and that's filtered down to many of the states. And you know, we have national figures from both parties that have made statements about, you know, whether you can believe the results. You know, the person that got elected wasn't legitimate. And we know that's not true, you know, that our elections are sound, but that coupled with social media and a lot of misinformation that is at play, I think really impacts the voters that are looking at that. They either believe what they read on social media at face value, or they don't know what to believe. And so, you know, it just makes these educational efforts that much more important. And I think that program you're working on is a really, really good idea. We, in New Hampshire, we have done a number of things to try and address that. And one is that we have increased our own presence on media, on social media, by putting out election fun facts. Just, you know, it talks about the checks and balances in elections and informs the voters on, you know, what actually occurs. And they're short snippets, but they are useful information. And the National Association of Secretaries of State has had a program for several elections now where it is, you know, election officials are your trusted source of information. So whenever the Secretary of State's office or a local election official puts something out, you can believe the content of that messaging. And then you know, we have to continue to do more to educate the public. You mentioned the committee that I put together on Special Committee on Voter Confidence. And that was to kind of combat, you know, the polarization, the untrue statements that were being made about the election process, and the skepticism and the scrutiny that, you know, our elections are under at all different levels. And scrutiny is healthy. I mean, I think it's important. People should question how things work. But I put together this commission, this committee, that had 8 members, equal participation from the 2 major political parties. Participants had really impressive backgrounds in terms of involvement in elections at different levels in the past. And they traveled around the state of New Hampshire and probably held 10 or a dozen sessions where they invited experts in different areas of elections to come and speak, whether they were pollsters or academics, political parties, and others. And then afterwards, they just opened it up for the general public to talk about what's on their mind. And we heard the whole spectrum of thoughts and beliefs, and it was a great exercise. It gave people the opportunity to vent and, you know, voice what they were feeling. And the committee really listened and heard and took all of the information they received and generated a report that talked about, you know, these are the things that are on voters' minds. Here's what we can do to help address them and, you know, give confidence back to the people that our elections are sound. And, I'm thinking of ways now to expand upon that. But I think it was a really, really important exercise that we also listen as part of this process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it seems like to some degree, I mean, and I wonder if either of you think there's sort of a tension. I mean, I think back, and both of you would be more familiar than this than myself, but, you know, the framing of, you know, our entire system of government in this country, you know, there's a tension about trust in government, like built into that, right? There's mechanisms meant to increase trust, but almost an assumption that you shouldn't by default trust. And you used the word earn before, Dave, which is an interesting word because I think a lot of folks in government don't see it that way. You know, they see themselves in the positions, well, I got elected, you know, or appointed or whatever. You know, I have the mandate, I have the, you know, responsibility, authority, whatever, to move forward here, and don't see it as a continuous process of creating that trust through all the actions that they do. And so I just wonder if either of you think, you know, is there an inherent tension? Is that tension a good thing? Is that a mechanism that sort of forces governments to be more accountable? And it sounds like to some degree there's basically a balancing act, you know, between kind of these different pieces. And it's, I don't know, in my mind I have an image of like a spinning plate, and you're just trying to keep it like, you know, it's always moving in a different direction, and that your office especially need to somehow figure out a way to not only plan these things out for the future, but respond to the dynamics that are happening now and make sure that people have ways to engage such that you all are hearing the feedback, which is important, but also that people have the opportunity to participate. And so they go home and then somebody says to them, oh, well, you can't trust any of those numbers. And they can say, well, hold on a second, that's not exactly true. Right. And like, I feel like sort of deputizing citizens as, I don't know what the right word is, but as people who can advocate for buying in when it's appropriate to do so, that seems important to us. I just wonder if either of you have a reflection on that. You know, is there sort of an inherent tension, you know, as far as trust in government, and is that a good thing?
There are tensions in a number of areas, I think, and just the election process itself, there's a natural tension between making it really easy to vote and making sure that the voters that are participating in the election are qualified. And when you tighten things up, it becomes less easy to vote. And when you make it easier to vote, then you're loosening up the security measures that might be in place. And so, you know, there's a tension involved there that finding that delicate balance that makes everyone, at least as most people, happy as possible is difficult to achieve. And then the other tension is that, you know, as secretaries of state, it would be great if we could just magically come up with the solution to these problems. But we have partners in this process. And, you know, the partners are the voters that participate in the elections. The partners are the legislators that make the laws that we have to follow. And then we have partners that are the local election officials that actually run the process. And the solutions that we have to find in concert. And there has to be cooperation among all of the participants that take place, which, you know, can make it a little unwieldy, but I think it also adds to you know, the confidence that people can have in the election process if they know all of that, that, you know, there's a lot at play to make these processes work properly.
Go ahead.
I think that Dave paints a really great picture of sort of the variety of viewpoints that go into setting the laws the way they are. You know, it's something that came out of the legislative process. You know, legislators have to answer to their constituents. So I'm sure in New Hampshire, it's much the way it is in Vermont. You're not going to vote for something that you couldn't explain to someone when you're standing in line at the grocery store or after church on Sunday morning. You just, you know, you are responsive to your neighbors. And so, you know, I think in that way, I have a lot of faith in government in our two states, because the government is so close to the people.
And that's the way our forefathers designed our system, because, you know, when they revolted against the King of England and created their own government, they wanted to spread the power of government as broadly across the population as they could. And that's why we have the types of governments that we have in New England, you know, especially Northern New England.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So if there's sort of these tensions, which maybe that's not exactly the right word, but it seems like an implicit ideology built into checks and balances between the three branches of government, and all these different pieces, we're not trusting one individual or one entity to be able to just sort of run the process forward. So if there is the tension, for lack of a better word, built into the process, I guess one of the questions would be, so if I've heard, you know, over the years, people say things like, if there's no conflict, there's no democracy, right? If you're living in a free society, quote unquote, and everybody's agreeing with each other, something's wrong. And because that just doesn't exist. And so if everybody seems like they're agreeing, what are we missing? And, you know, I believe that from a management perspective, right? If you have a team and everybody's saying yes to the boss, something's wrong, because nobody's got ideas that are that good. But if there are tensions built into the system, I guess one of the questions I have is, how do we then sort of how do we work through that process in a way that we can ensure is constructive towards the overall goals of the system? And I think that's something that we see becoming more and more of a challenge at the national level, at the state level, at the local level, is people having different viewpoints but participating in a constructive fashion together. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if you all have any thoughts on that. We've got tension built in. How do we make sure that we have the right infrastructure in place so that that's directed in a constructive fashion?
Mm-hmm. Well, my observation is that that tension is helpful as long as the people who are coming around the table to make the decisions are ultimately willing to compromise and see the other person's perspective, so that you can try to find a way to meet the needs of both. You know, the vast majority of bills during my time in the legislature were passed unanimously, you know, by voice vote, because the committees had you know, all parties sitting around the table and came to a consensus on how to move forward. And, you know, it's the few places where there is a lot of strife and disagreement that tend to get a lot of attention in the media. But I think a lot of what I observe in lawmaking at the state level in Vermont is that the people are coming together across the table and finding a way to compromise.
And broad participation is really important. And frankly, that's the way we've set up our forms of government in New Hampshire and Vermont, where, you know, many towns still have a traditional town meeting where townspeople go and they have a good conversation about, you know, what the articles are that they're going to pass. And people speak up and, you know, collectively they make a decision on it. And, you know, to some extent, starting to get away from that a little bit. In New Hampshire, we have official ballot town meetings now, but there's still a deliberative session, not as well attended as the traditional town meetings are. But the important message is, people should accept the responsibility to just understand what the issues are that should be important to them, especially the ones that are local, and educate themselves on it and speak up and, you know, let people know how you feel, and then vote your conscience on it.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to learning about the traditional town meetings that you just mentioned. In a few months here in Hanover, that will be my first New England town meeting. So I'm excited for that. But one of the things that you both touched on there that I want to call out is the value of bringing different viewpoints to the table in the decision-making process. And I think that is one area. I mean, there's so many things that are brilliant about the way our government is set up in, you know, our constitutional framework. But one of the things that seemed to happen over the, I don't know the source of it, but it seems like one of the things that has happened is, to some degree, especially at the national level right now, that's not happening as much. And basically, whoever has the majority clears the room out, to so to speak, and then they make a decision. And then if people disagree with that decision, the next election, they run against that, and then it swings the other direction, then they clear the room out, then they make the decision. And we've got a lot of that sort of swinging back and forth to some degree, this pendulum shifting, that doesn't encourage, you know, it's sort of this winner takes all to some degree. You know, once you're in charge, you've got the mandate. Even though a lot of elections, especially at the federal level, especially on the House side, you know, where there's competitive primaries, very small numbers of voters ultimately are casting affirmative votes for some of those folks who get elected, with, you know, large percentages not voting in the primary or whatever the things are. But people come in and say, well, you know, I'm making the decisions now, and they're not proactive about bringing in all those different perspectives and stakeholder groups. Do you have any advice for folks out there from your experiences, you know, in the legislature, building consensus around bills, or at the state level, at the statewide level, on the executive side, like the special committee you mentioned? Any advice for people that, because some of what, as I've sort of advocated for similar things over the years, some people are nervous about that. You know, they're nervous about bringing in people who disagree with them because they feel like it's going to, you know, sideline the conversation. And I make the plea that it's going to be worse if you don't bring them in. Mm-hmm. Unless you want nobody to ever participate at all, which is not really a great value. assuming that at some point people will know the decision you made, don't you want them bought in, even if they don't totally agree? And I just wonder if there's anything that you found particularly productive or helpful or unhelpful in sort of building that consensus and bringing different people into the room.
I think that sharp swings and rapid swings of the pendulum, you know, based on, you know, clearing out, you know, the party that was in before, is not helpful to the administration of elections.
Right.
You know, especially in today's world where, you know, we're looking at technology more and more as part of the election process. And, you know, those decisions can be impacted by, you know, whoever is the party in power. From my perspective, I would like to see election-related legislation pass with bipartisan support and not just, you know, split party decisions, because, you know, that's every time the pendulum swings, there's a good chance that that legislation is going to get reversed the next time around. And so for the sake of continuity and, you know, moving in a forward direction, you know, I would just assume to see our public policy pass with bipartisan support so that, you know, we can plan on how elections should continue to run.
That's a great goal.
Yeah.
Especially for sensitive subject areas.
Right. And it's, you know, particular to election policy, I think incremental consensus change is the way to go, because that anytime you make a change in election law, it has to be disseminated out to the local elections officials. And so the more change you're throwing into that system, the more opportunity there is for someone to have you know, misunderstood what the change was, or either on the side of the voter or on the side of somebody, you know, who's always worked their local elections and maybe wasn't fully aware of the change. So, you know, I think it's important that with respect to how we protect our democracy, that these changes be made very carefully and thoughtfully.
Interesting. So thinking about trust still, but from a slightly different perspective, I wonder if either of you have reflections on. So one of the things that I try to think about, you know, we have on the local level so many sort of daily touch points with people as far as all the services that are kind of provided to your just public at large, where a lot of folks may not even know that this is something. They may not know who provides what or what land they're on or who conserves and provides maintenance on the trails and all those different things. Of course, I think we all wish that everybody knew how all those pieces worked, but we know the education component is important there. But one of the you know, things is just a person living in the world. You know, there's been a number of times where I've interacted with government, you know, filing documents, or during COVID, there was a period of time where I was receiving unemployment in New Jersey, and it was really dehumanized. The experience was really like, I mean, it was calling every day and getting an automated message that said, we have too many calls today, call back tomorrow, for a month in a row.
Yeah.
I mean, hundreds of calls and emails. And, you know, fortunately, you know, I think there were plenty of people in the state and around the country, when we think about that time period, who were in a much more challenging financial, I mean, they're looking at the end of the week and, you know, where are they going to buy groceries next week? And they can't even get through to somebody on the phone. And I think about things like that as a manager of government on a daily basis. Are we building trust in the way that we provide services and interact with people on a daily basis? And I think in a lot of the cases, the answer is probably not. You know, I think about someone having a negative encounter like that. How likely is that person going to be? There's part of me that wants to think, okay, that person's going to be frustrated, so they're going to get involved and change it. But no, if you're worried about, you know, feeding your family, you don't have that capacity to run for a position like, you know, and spend 10 hours a week, 20 hours a week volunteering your time, paying expenses your own way. You know, there's so many people who can't even access running for local office, whole other layer of issues. And so I wonder, is that something, you know, something I'm trying to think about on the local level here, people navigating building permits, opening a new business, something that's relevant at the Secretary of State office as well. You know, can we do government in a way that helps buy people in and build that trust over time, so all the touch points are all little tiny incremental pieces to get people kind of bought into the process?
I love this question because it really resonates with me, because one of the things that I have been most pleased with as I was running for the office of Secretary of State, and now as I'm getting into the office and have been there for about 5 weeks, is I always hear from people who say, it was so great dealing with your Office of Professional Regulation. You know, I had a question, I went on the website, I found the answer there. Or I had a question, I couldn't find the answer, I called somebody, and they called me back, like right away. and so, you know, from that standpoint, I think trust really does need to also be earned in the way that we give customer service to our constituents. You know, people who are waiting for their license renewal to come through are, you know, this is a serious matter of, am I going to be able to bring home a paycheck this week?
Right.
And it is our duty to make sure that we turn that around as quickly and smoothly as possible. And in fact, an example of something that we're trying this week that's a little bit new, Vermont just joined the Interstate Nurse Compact, which means that for the first time, Vermont nurses, when they're renewing their license, will have to go through the criminal background check that's required by this Interstate Compact. It's a new thing for Vermont nurses, and many of them were too busy to read the reminder emails or the instruction emails, and they're starting to get really frustrated because the deadline's coming. So yesterday we filmed a quick video, quick introduction. Just want to reassure you that you will still be able to practice while you're waiting for your criminal background check to come through, and then, you know, a little screen share of this is how you navigate the system to get your application going. Just recognizing that many people right now are so stressed and strapped. You know, their daycare closes at 3 and they have to figure out how to get their kids taken care of from 3 to 6 when they get off work, or, you know, so many changes to people's sort of way of life during the pandemic and since then, and recognizing that we need to rethink the way we offer services to folks because the way folks are receiving that information has changed as well.
Hmm. Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. You know, it's the role of government to be as responsive as possible to its constituents. And especially with the use of technology, there are new and better ways to do that, to make it easier for constituents to do business with government. I think there's a greater expectation on the part of our citizens that, you know, that needs to happen. And, you know, we do the best we can with the resources that we have to just, you know, make sure that we respond and take care of the needs of our constituents.
Hmm. So one other area that I'll throw out as far as thinking about trust is one of the things that over the last few years I've come across a few times is the role of public libraries in civic engagement and trust building. It seems like, you know, the surveys that come out, public libraries seem to often be the highest, most trusted government entity out there, and that I think they're generally seen as not particularly partisan in nature. And one of the things, thinking through some of these things, I, you know, spent a little time reaching out to some different librarians and library directors in my network. And one of the things that was interesting that I guess I didn't quite realize until I started talking to folks was, you know, thinking about especially, it was trying to design with a middle school, a civics curriculum last year, and we had a module on, you know, researching information and kind of misinformation and things like that. And so I'm asking, you know, looking at what programs libraries have and asking them, and said, well, librarians already play this role currently because in a lot of communities, people go into the library and ask a question where they're looking for more information, and the librarian is then in this sort of position where maybe the person comes in and the question is like totally based on some obvious, you know, false assumption or something, and the person can kind of say, you know, they've got a choice of how to respond to that person, and that they, you know, that they try really hard to kind of bring people in and say, okay, well, that's interesting. You know, well, tell me what source, and they're going to sit down at the computer. What source did you get that from? Well, let's look at other sources. And here's, well, this place is, you know, this is a .edu. This is a .com. That might have been a, you know, leaning this way and that way. And I remember even back, you know, the sort of like information literacy classes when I was younger, one of the questions which I've tried to get folks to shy away from a little bit is this an unbiased source or not? And asking the question is, what is the bias of the source? And not assuming that there are any sources that don't have a bias. But just navigating that, libraries seem really interestingly positioned to play a role. And part of my you know, expectation was that libraries are going to be protective of that status and be hesitant to step their foot in the middle of sort of controversies. But, and this is in no way representative, but the handful of folks that I've talked to, their reaction has been the opposite, that they want to leverage their position as being a sort of trusted institution to do something maybe more than what they're able to do now. And I was just curious if that's, I don't know. I just think about what are the institutions that we have in place? What are their roles that they could be in the future? And libraries seems to keep popping up as one. Could we do more innovative things there? I don't know if there's any movement on things like that at the state level in either New Hampshire or Vermont, or if that's come across. Just throw that out there for discussion.
I had never thought of libraries in that way before, but you know, if I stereotype a librarian, yeah, that stereotype is probably the least political person that,
right,
you know, that I would think of, and you know, based on that, yeah, you know, they probably have that credibility just from holding that position of being a person you can trust, and that will, you know, maybe not give you the information, but tell you where you can go,
right,
and find it, and you know, draw your own conclusions. That's an interesting point.
Well, you've sparked an idea for me anyway, because remember, phase two of our education and civic engagement is really going to be to get out there into communities with adults who maybe have forgotten how government works and how they learned about civics and civic participation. And libraries in most small communities in Vermont are very much a gathering point and a place where people come for trusted information, but also a place where people come for, you know, for small group gatherings and, you know, book discussions. And so that's another, perhaps, set of allies who could help get that information out to community members.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah, I would imagine most would probably be interested in that.
Yeah, I mean, we live in a democracy, so I could see librarians wanting to be a part of the team of people helping folks understand how to operate within a democracy and how to make that democracy work for you.
That's exactly what some of the libraries I had talked to, we were looking at some grant opportunities around doing the sort of how to navigate the process sort of workshops in libraries, and they were really interested in playing that role. One that we had thrown out with a few and was a little more, it was just like, this is going to be a really fine line to walk, you know, is that I think we're having a harder and harder time accessing information, in that we have, it's too much, it's a fire hose every time you go online, and you don't really know all the time who's writing the information that you're seeing or where it's coming from, and people are copying and pasting stuff in different places, and you don't know the original source of these things. And I think we're finding out, you know, that there's sometimes outside influences at work, or just influences, whether it's an advertiser, it's not our interests in mind. But librarians are, you know, information organizing and finding experts. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've not done, but I've been sort of just like, you know, kind of chewing on for the last year or two is, you know, think about local issues in a community, budget issues, the kind of things that cyclically draw up controversy. And, you know, libraries have collections on different topic and subject matters. You know, could you create a collection in the library of the turf field debate, you know, between natural and artificial turf, the budget from this year, you know, borrowing money for non-large scale capital, and just try to create a place where if someone then has a question, instead of just going to a search engine and looking at who knows what, but maybe there's a starting point in a local community where they can find information first. And what's just so striking about what both of you have talked about multiple times is the value of the small scale of the accountability mechanisms in New Hampshire and in Vermont. I don't know how you do that at the, you know, at the 300, 400 million person level, but it seems like the value is like unquestionable in our communities. And when I talk to our local election, I mean, everybody knows everybody. And like the ability for fraud to perpetuate there with all of these different people and all these different incentives looking at the process does seem really difficult. But so we built this local infrastructure on the election side, and it's sort of like, what can we learn from that process, and are there things that we can facilitate on the local side? You know, are there ways that we could sort of expand that into other areas to create local infrastructure in areas right now where there really isn't any? And information finding is one of those things. Mm-hmm. You know, is your library your first stop, basically, if you have a question about the town budget, you know, or is it Facebook? And I imagine the library version of that is probably going to be a little more credible.
Right. So it does call, you know, calls to mind that your task should always be, let's make sure we have a briefing with the librarians before, you know, before we head into budget season.
Right.
You know,
right, because they're getting that feedback informally currently, I think, from people.
And, you know, if they have the information in advance, then, you know, they can anticipate how to answer citizens' questions. So they are a great resource from that standpoint.
That's a great idea. And, you know, you talked about how do you do it at the national level.
Right.
You know, these ideas start small. And you know, they're innovative. And when they work, it's great to take them to a conference like the National Association of Secretaries of State, where you can kind of share these innovative ideas, and other states may pick them up and start using them as a model in their own state. But all the states are different too, and what works in New Hampshire and Vermont might not work as well on the West Coast.
But it's great that you have access to those networks. I mean, I find those valuable on my end too, is getting to learn from other other people. So even if it's not directly translatable, there might be lessons.
Right. I find that when I interact with leaders from other states, I'm always thinking about, well, how can I scale that down to be Vermont scale, right? You know, because I'm not going to have a staff of 17 who are going to be helping to create this, you know, civics curriculum or this outreach and engagement to educate voters across the state. But I, you know, like, we can figure out how to scale it to something that works. So maybe other states will look at what we do in our small states and try to think of ways to scale it up.
Yeah.
Right. We'll let them worry about that question.
Right.
Yeah. So something else that would be interesting to chat about a little bit is, you know, for folks that are listening and may not be familiar with either of your backgrounds, you know, we've talked about a lot today so far that there's a lot of alignment about how we build trust, the importance of some of those processes, how we're thinking about election credibility. You know, we have a Democrat elected official, a Republican elected official, an unaffiliated host. So I think, you know, we've got most folks covered here at the table. And, you know, obviously we're seeing partisanship is a challenge at the national level and I think at different state levels as well. And it seems like, so, you know, last year, I spent 4 months driving across the country and, you know, spent all this time, some of these pictures and things you see around here, you know, out in these, like, beautiful, you know, national, and talk about good policy, you know, protected, conserved, you know, national parks and national forests, amazing.
Yeah.
But, you know, spent time in a bunch of different towns and cities all over the country. And, you know, it was interesting because I came across some dynamics, especially when I was in Montana, that, you know, so I had a friend who was in the state legislature in Montana, and, you know, I was getting some tips ahead of time, you know, on where to visit. And one of his first questions, you know, most people going to Montana, you know, oh, I'm going to Bozeman, you know, basically his reaction, I actually didn't end up visiting Bozeman at all, but his, you know, his response was basically, oh, that's great. You know, when people ask him, you know, I'm going to Bozeman, what should I do next? He said, well, when you're done visiting Bozeman, you should visit Montana. because there's been so much redevelopment and gentrification in the city. And when I was out in that area, there were some folks that I met in, you know, on some, I think it was Bureau of Land Management land, and we were out camping. And one of them, I mean, he, you know, lived in Montana his whole life and, you know, was just reflecting on some of the changes he'd seen and some of the issues that I wasn't aware, you know, I just didn't have any visibility into this before going out there, about how much effort there was at trying to preserve local culture and history in some of these communities, as so many people from the East Coast, West Coast, other places are moving out there and sort of turning the city into the places where they came from. And then I think about how much of that kind of work I've been involved in on the East Coast, around New Jersey, New York City, the folks out there who are talking about preservation of local history and culture in their cities tended to be more right-leaning. The folks that I've worked with on some of those issues, like around the New York City metro area, tended to be more left-leaning. I said, well, wait a second. Everywhere around the country, I think we're struggling with revitalizing communities in ways that don't just pave over whoever was there and put you know, a mall on top of it, for lack of a better, more nuanced description. And it's just like, this is such, there's so many things like this that feel like we're really actually on the same page about what we want. And, you know, this conversation makes me feel a little bit like that as well. And I just was curious if you've seen those dynamics, you know, within your state, between members of different parties. You know, is there anybody who doesn't want more civic education? Is there anybody on the sort of other side of some of these things that we talked about? Because it feels like most people, this is one of these sorts of issues where it's an untapped opportunity to build bridges between communities that might feel divided.
Yeah, I don't think that I've met a person who, when I described the civic engagement position, didn't nod their head vigorously and say, you know, some version of, oh my goodness, this is absolutely, you are so right, this is what we need. And to me, it really, you know, teaching people how to participate in a democracy is the most apolitical thing in the world, because it doesn't matter whether you want to defend hunting and trapping rights or whether you want to, you know, advance, you know, I don't know, ranked choice voting or you know, pick any issue. And what matters is that people know how to petition their government to hear what it is that they're trying to accomplish. And it could be that they're trying to make sure that the culture doesn't change from the way they grew up and what they were used to. In Vermont, the conversation is around, you know, at this moment, is around the preservation of town meeting day. Because during the pandemic, we gave communities the ability to shift to a ballot vote for their municipal elections and budget adoption, because we didn't think it was safe for people to be gathering in large numbers in a town meeting setting. And some communities liked being able to do it by ballot and are going to stay with that. And other communities are fiercely defending the institution of town meeting as this is the way we do government. So I think that's wonderful. It's a great example of people participating in their government, in their local government and democracy. And it's a healthy dynamic.
Yeah, and I think it depends on what the issue is, on how partisan or polarized it might be. And I think civic education is one that people can buy in pretty broadly. You know, in New Hampshire, we're looking at the new generation of ballot counting devices. I think Vermont has already switched over, but you know, that has uniform support. But when you start getting into issues like no excuse absentee voting or things like that, you're going to have a heck of a debate before you get anywhere on that. And those issues or those items where you can have broad buy-in are usually the building blocks of being able to expand beyond that and get people to work together, you know, find solutions for other different aspects related to elections that are more controversial.
Well, and so I'll go back to a topic earlier from that comment, which is that I think one of the things that might be valuable for folks that are trying to think about ways to get towards more consensus-based decision-making is to start with things that you know you've got broad agreement on, right? And use those first to kind of get everybody bought in. And, you know, one of my favorite books, I don't know if it's in here, Decisions in Philadelphia, which is about the Constitutional Convention, they talked about how they sort of, you know, changed a lot of the parliamentary procedure that we might be more used to, such as, you know, once something is voted on, once there's a motion made, a second, and it's voted on, to bring it up again is out of order, where they did the opposite. And the rules, you know, for those couple weeks were anything can be brought up again, no matter how many times it's been brought up before. And the goal was to try to get people to agree to stuff and then kind of move on from it. And then, you know, people sort of forget the things they disagreed about because there's agreement on so much other stuff. And it's just this brilliant, you know, you think about, obviously there were a lot of voices missing in the room at that time, but there were also some pretty divergent, you know, directions of where people wanted to go and different interests, and managed to get that document written. You know, I think about, I know that was on the ballot this year in New Hampshire, right, a constitutional convention. I wonder if we put people together today, how well that would go without having some of those fundamental, I don't know, if, you know, but there's so many brilliant ways to try to build that consensus, and you're just touching on one of them, so I wanted to call that out as far as getting people bought into things that you might be able to agree about first, and then sort of moving towards maybe the areas of greater disagreement. Even if you know it's coming, just let it, you know, instead of starting there, which I think sometimes we tend to do in our policy debates. I don't know if either of you feel that way, where people jump right into sort of their solutions, and we haven't even agreed on what the problems are yet.
Well, as chair of a policy committee in the legislature, I would often use the tact of, you know, let's go through the bill once, you know, all 30 pages or whatever. Let's go through it once. Let's decide, you know, which of these things we all agree on and we can check off and say, you know, that this is good. We're done with this section because we all agree that it's done right. And then we'll come back to those places where we have disagreement and
right.
try to find out where the compromise is. Maybe it's just adding another phrase. Maybe it's, you know, slightly changing the wording. I think building consensus on the things that you can agree on is a really healthy place to start and helps people, I think, feel better about the ultimate process than if you don't, you know, if you dive right into the areas of differences. I find that sometimes leaves a bad taste in people's mouths.
Yeah. Even the process of what you just mentioned, the sort of tactic of going through something once and then going back and going through it again,
mm-hmm.
that's something that I don't know. I mean, maybe I don't see people do that very often.
Mm-hmm.
You sort of like go through, and as you get to the thing you disagree about, then you get stuck there, basically.
Right.
Right, and you don't realize that was the one area you disagreed. Everything else you actually agreed on, but you never even got there.
Right,
right.
Yeah, if you're trying to drive to, you know, an ultimate conclusion and keep an idea moving forward, I find it's better to recognize and you know, shake hands over the things that we can all agree on, and then, you know, at the end of the day, if you can't come to agreement, maybe you just take that section out and the rest of the idea
right.
moves forward, but you couldn't agree on this one section. So
not letting the perfect be the enemy of the good, right?
You know, I don't think you can function in a democracy if you really believe that it has to be perfect, because, you know, there have been so many times in the legislative process, but also just sitting in local town meeting where hearing somebody else's perspective on something has changed my mind, right? So if I come in with this hard black and white, you know, what my idea is the right way, and I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to agree to anything that isn't perfect in my mind.
Right.
I may miss out on the fact that, you know, that Dave's got more experience in that area and that he can actually show me how my way isn't the perfect way. And, you know, maybe we should compromise.
It's better to move the ball down the field than be all or nothing. You know, it's...
Right. Interesting. Yeah. And not exactly how our government seems to be set up. So, yeah.
Well, what's interesting is, you know, the things that the media wants to cover are the places where there's disagreement,
right.
where there's people who are backed into corners and lobbing bombs at each other, because that's dramatic and that's, you know, there's a lot to write about there. It's not as exciting to say, oh, they just, you know, they just went through a 30-page bill and agreed on,
everything.
You know, 29 pages
right,
of it.
Right. Yeah, that is the interesting thing, thinking about the biases of the sources that you might get information from, you know, the difference, you know, between, you know, a Facebook or even any most news outlets. I mean, they're benefiting, you know, they are getting paid. Their business model is largely based on advertising. That advertising is based on views. And so, but your librarian isn't, right? They're not getting paid more or less based on, you know, whether what they're telling you is kind of catchy or,
right.
or not. But all of these different platforms that we use, it's not malevolent necessarily, at least on an individual basis, maybe on a systemic basis, you could argue. But I don't think folks think about that. And it's the same way, you know, in any governing body or legislative body, the people who show up, it's a huge negative response bias, right? Most people are not coming to say, I just wanted to come out tonight, and I just think this is pretty good. Not great, not bad, pretty good. Thank you. Those are my comments. Like, how often has that happened?
Right,
yeah. But if we don't know that, and we just base on what we're seeing, you know, that can really skew the decision making. And I wonder if there's ways to engage people so that it's not, so that we can even out that negative response bias a little bit. So at least elected officials or decision makers at any institutional level have a little bit more broader access to public feedback. Mm-hmm. Maybe if there's easier ways for people to provide that feedback. You know, I worry sometimes about you don't want to kind of oversimplify things too much. But at the end of the day, I don't know, maybe that's better than that voice not being heard at all. Because mm-hmm. That negative response bias is really tough.
It's true. I always appreciate the opportunities, and having a small town cafe during the time that I was in the legislature was really helpful. But, you know, just to randomly ask someone who walks, you know, have you heard about, you know, Bill S-132 and what do you think about it? And, you know, most people weren't necessarily paying really close attention, but if you explained a little bit more about what the bill was doing, they would say, oh yeah, that seems fine, you know, or that makes a lot of sense. And so none of those people would ever reach out and say, we think you should vote for this bill, because they just didn't have a strong opinion about it one way or the other. But that response bias of the, you hear from the people who are amped up either in favor of or against is.
And those people usually don't have a problem making sure you get that message.
Right.
Yeah. So it's helpful to ask, who am I not hearing from?
Right.
No. I have always found that the people that I was not hearing from were, you know, the parents who have, you know, little kids in elementary school, because they're just trying to get home, get dinner on the table, get the kids off to bed and get up tomorrow and do it all over again. So sometimes reaching out and asking them questions was really helpful, because you give them an opportunity to engage in something that they, you know, maybe hadn't had time to think about or engage in.
So that's another kind of great value. And there's been a few that we've talked about. I'm probably going to forget some of them, but I mean, so this latest one, you could maybe call this something like being proactive as far as soliciting feedback or getting input on things and not just kind of waiting for people to come to you. That seems important. Building in people who disagree or people that you know have different perspectives into the process, seems valuable. As well, beginning with things where there's consensus and working towards things where there's disagreement, you know, these are all things that for folks that are listening, if they're, you know, thinking about ways, maybe they're in a community where they're trying to engage at a local level. Those are like three tangible, concrete mechanisms that maybe could help move that ball forward in that person's thinking. Mm-hmm.
One thing that I think is important for folks who are thinking about getting involved, and it is one of the rules of procedure in the Vermont House, and I'm sure that you have an equivalent, and that is that you should never impugn the motives of another person. You should always listen to what they say, listen to, you know, their rationale for or against the issue, but don't ever assume that their motives are bad or evil or wrong. Because that's the first rift that causes people to back into their own corners.
Agreed. If I may take a moment now, I'm just thinking of something. So there's the where I went to college, Hampshire College, the former president lives in Norwich, just across the river in Vermont, Greg Prince. And there's this document, I just met him recently, but I had used this document that he had put together actually when he worked at Dartmouth College before Hampshire. And it'll take me just a second. There's these seven principles of discourse that maybe I'll just read out and just see, because one of them is exactly like what you're kind of saying there. And these frameworks for how we have civil conversations seems really, this is a document I've used since I went to college and, you know, in South Orange when I was mayor, all these different places, like, you know, that we value truth and the process of seeking truth as ends in themselves. That's pretty good. That we accept responsibility to articulate a position as close to the truth as one can make it, using to the best of one's ability available evidence and the rules of reason, logic, and relevance. that we listen openly, recognizing always that new information may alter one's position. It's a good one, right? Mm-hmm. That we welcome evaluation and accept and even encourage disagreement and criticism, even to the point of seeking out for ourselves that which will dispower our own position. That we refuse to reduce disagreement to personal attacks or attacks on groups or classes of individuals. That we value civility even in disagreement. And lastly, that we reject the premise that the ends, no matter how worthy, can justify means which violate these principles. Mm-hmm. Isn't that great?
Yeah.
That is great.
I'll email you both the link to that if you're curious. I just, came across this, 10 or 15, that's how long ago, college, 15 years ago. And it's just been so helpful since then because I feel like these frameworks are so valuable. And, we used to read these out sometimes before starting meetings and just sort of a reminder to people. And we've talked about that here, our meetings are pretty, we have a pretty, I would say, amicable, and people trust each other in the process in Hanover. I think we're lucky in a lot of ways. And that may not last forever either. And so how do we build infrastructure in our community so that when people come out and participate, there's some expectations of how to participate. Mm-hmm. And that if someone says, well, I believe this, say, well, you would believe, no, we're not engaging with that. Right. And yes. How can we do, right. So I want to be respectful of both your times. I think I've got a whole bunch more questions I wish I could ask, and maybe we'll do a round two at some point. Is there anything that you all, I know the Secretary of State's office, is expansive well beyond, the topics that we covered here today. We talked about that a little in the beginning, but is there anything that either of you wanted to share or talk about that we didn't really get to cover or that you just wanted to, let folks know about who might be listening?
Well, I think both of our offices are in charge of state archives, right? And, the fascinating thing that I'm recognizing now is that in this digital era, now that, I've just moved into my office and cleared out all of the file cabinets and all of the, my desk doesn't have drawers that are full of files. It's really all on my computer. The way that governments are creating documents now is it gives us a fascinating ability to search through the records of state government in a way that before, when you had to physically find that piece of paper that had that information on it, perhaps without a good search function. And so I think it's really exciting to see not only the potential for people to be able to follow along and see what their government is doing, but future historians to be able to look back at this time and see what went into the process of making decisions. It's pretty exciting. It's also a little overwhelming because, good file keeping when it's paper is really easy to see because it's not, you don't see stacks of detritus everywhere, and you notice that, that only the things that are important are being preserved. And in the digital era, boy, I think it gets really easy to just leave everything in the in the file and just keep adding on more information. So I in some ways feel bad for future historians because they may have a lot of memos and reminders about the upcoming holiday party to sort through as they're trying to look for the real relevant information.
Well, sure, it's all going to be an AI robot doing the searching anyway, so they're probably going to be fine.
I hope so.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah.
And along those lines, we have a brand new digitization center in the archives, and it's going to give us the ability to put online a lot of the really neat historical documents that we have, Revolutionary War records, Civil War records, and everything in between. And we're pretty excited about that.
It's pretty neat to think of making all that information available to, to a fourth grader working on, their school report.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I mean, the public document piece is interesting because for so long, I think government's been used to having documents in file cabinets, which I can say I have not opened either of these. At some point, I will find time to... I know they're filled with stuff, but I've never used them, so I don't know how relevant it is on a daily basis. But we're used to having documents in that format. But But then we think about all the stuff that we do that really is, there, a lot of that is going to be public information. And could it be of greater use to the broader community? And I think about, you know, I mean, we probably all use things like, you know, Waze or Google Maps on a regular basis. And, you know, the public transit data and the road data, I mean, all that stuff came from governments, you know, and most of that stuff came from governments. And you think about public transit agencies, you know, they, you know, a lot of the cities that got really out ahead, especially with the mapping softwares that have the public transit directions, they just said, here's our, you know, here's an API, you figure out how to do something with this. We have the schedules because we have, because we maintain the systems, but you can, you know, private sector, you can figure out what to build on top of it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's probably all sorts of really cool things that we haven't even thought about that if we just take our files and put them online, somebody's going to figure out something interesting to do with those things. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of cool.
And all of this information belongs to all of us. So,
right.
Yeah, so it's great that we're able to do that.
Yeah. Well, I really appreciate both of you coming out here to talk about this stuff. And I'll say as well, you know, I just think that for as far as the kinds of things that, you know, people in the public know about or don't know about of what happens behind the scenes in government, you know, both of you have been in government for a long period of time working on these issues in relatively newer positions on the Secretary of State side, exactly as is doing this. And I just want to, I guess, thank you both for all of this. I mean, this is just so exciting to hear about the different work that you're each doing on these topics, because all of this seems like a meta issue. If we can't figure out this kind of stuff, free and fair elections and trust in government in a way that is appropriately earned, all those pieces, we can't do anything without those things in place.
Right.
And so I'm sure you do get folks who give you the thumbs up and thank yous as well, but just as one person in government to others, like, thank you for putting so much effort and focus in those areas. It's very important. Yeah.
Well, it's been a lot of fun to sit and talk through these issues with you both, and thank you for pulling this together.
Yeah, sure. And I hope we can do it again sometime in the not too distant future.
That would be great. Yeah, maybe we can get through our traditional town meeting in Hanover, and then we can reflect on those experiences. Yeah. But yeah, thank you again. Yeah.
Hey everyone, and thanks for checking out this special spotlight episode of Hanover Happenings. If you'd like to find all of the episodes of our Hanover Happenings podcast and prior updates, you can do so at hanoverhappenings.com or on wherever you listen to podcasts. If you'd like more information about other things happening in town, such as monthly reports, agendas, minutes, events, videos, and more, you can do so at hanovernh.org. Thanks again for engaging with what's happening in your community.